Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, back with episode 28, Paleolithic Solution. What's going on?
Nothing new. The sun is shining, the gato is happy, and, you know, life is good.
Yes, when the gato is happy, all is well with the world.
What's cracking with you? Deadlift PRs or anything else?
No successful deadlift PRs. Nothing, man. Playing a little more single leg work, Rob. So we're going to see how that goes. A little work on some of my hip instability issues.
Are you planning to win like a one-legged ass-kicking contest or something? Or
no, Rob, we're just going to see how it impacts my cranky hip.
Cool.
As Kelly Starrett says, these hips feel like they're from different people.
Like that's there's some Frankenstein jokes just waiting to happen there, but I'll
I know.
Keep it quiet since you're way bigger than I am. So
there's lots of stuff to mine with that, Rob. But we're gonna keep it professional here.
Sweet.
All right. So this is as stated by Rob Wolf, what could be a beefy episode. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, there's a couple of questions here that individually could almost be a whole episode by themselves. So we'll see if I either get confused or make everybody else confused in it, and then we may just shut it all down. So.
Or if you just slam down the microphone and walk away, we'll know that this episode puts you over the edge.
That's a sign that the interview is over.
All right, first question from Mike. Rob, a segment on adrenal would be great, even if you add some insight on how you are dealing with it yourself. Personally, I feel like I've been towing the line on adrenal fatigue for most of my adult life, and lately I feel like I'm getting closer to the bad side of that line. I do pretty well with the paleo plus some dairy, fish oil, vitamin D, natural calm at night, and as gluten-free as possible. I even cut the amount of caffeine or of coffee in recent years, and I've debated switching what I do drink to decaf, as I like the taste of coffee, and caffeine has never had much of an effect on me anyway. Would love to hear your thoughts on the topic. Thank you for all the great work you do.
Gosh, this also could be rather large. In the book, I end up doing a huge lifestyle factor, just an addressment. Sleep, stress, exercise, just our own perception of stress. Different people are wired up differently. Polakin calls this, what was his term for this? The wolf versus dog kind of scenario. And his whole thing was that, you know, certain people say like they go into military special forces or like very high stress kind of scenarios, and these people just tend to have a favorable hormonal response to legitimately like nail biting stressful situations. And you know, we would call these people type A. I think that no matter who you are, even if you tend to be more of this type of personality, you can reach points of overload. This may change as you get older. You could get sick, and it could modify the way that you respond to stress. So, I mean, it's kind of the same old stuff. We have dietary factors that can affect our adrenals. Elevated insulin can start releasing cortisol, can be a stressor. Food intolerances can be a stressor. Overeating or undereating can be a stressor. Then, obviously, sleep is a major factor in how we're dealing with stress and cortisol. And then training volume, periodization, just our perception of training too. Like, do we actually like what we're doing? People who love the activity that they're doing, it just registers much less stressful. And this is some of the interesting stuff about even, you know, kind of CrossFit type training or, you know, asking yourself, why am I doing what I'm doing? If it's kind of like ego-driven type stuff, just kind of keeping up with the Joneses, I think it tends to be a lot more stressful versus like, I just like doing this and I like being competitive or whatever. Like, there's some very different internal versus external motivations that can change the way that a situation is stressful. And I think it's worth, you know, keeping in mind with regards to all that stuff. But the whole lifestyle thing is huge, and it's very, very individualistic. The coffee thing is pretty individual. Matt Lalonde would say don't do any, and I can kind of see where he's coming from. My one thing with the coffee is if you are in a spot where you're really not overwhelmed by stress and you can really keep your intake at pretty moderate levels, and moderate unfortunately for me is taking it in at much lower levels than what I would probably like, then I think there's probably kind of an ergogenic effect, a performance enhancing effect. There's some antioxidants and some other kind of good stuff that comes out of it, but you really need to keep an eye on it. I think you can get some benefit out of decaf just from like the antioxidant effect if that's the way you want to roll with that. But the whole, you know, adrenal scene, it you know, should be figured into the overall hormonal profile, whether you're male or female, trying to keep some optimized hormonal states. And that is dependent upon who you are, where you want to be. Like, are you looking towards like a health and longevity bias? Are you looking at like a performance bias? Are you focused on a specific athletic activity? And then that can start steering where you're driving all this stuff.
Rob, have you you want to talk a little bit about how you address your adrenal stuff with your training?
Sure. You know, I didn't address it very well for a long time. I was very ineffective at it. And a lot of that is, I think, a little bit, again, of this type A personality where, and I've been used to being at a high level at different stuff I've been into over the years. And at some point, that can kind of catch up with you, especially when you're trying to do several things at once. And the thing that I consistently did was that I would start to feel a little better. Like, I would focus on my sleep. I would get a little bit of capacity built back up, and then I would start burning things too hard again, you know, particularly from kind of mixed modal exercise type stuff. And I always did pretty well within the you know, when I was doing more CrossFit-esque type stuff, but instinctively, I always kept things on the shorter side. I always modified my movement pool, you know, stuff like an Angie. I thought doing 100 air squats was just kind of silly, and so I would modify what I was up to with that. I would do ladders of like jumping squats, dips and pull-ups that were weighted, and I did really well with that. Like, I ended up doing a lot less total movements and a lot less time spent doing that. And it wasn't until I started pushing out 30-minute long workouts that I started having some really big problems. And that, coupled with travel, particularly like East Coast, West Coast type travel, was really problematic for me. So what I've done is I just don't push anything that is kind of metabolic related. Even when I've been doing some Thai boxing lately, it's about a 70 to 85% effort. Like, I usually know that I've got a little bit of capacity left in the tank, and I'm just trying to build volume and intensity slowly. And to the degree that I've done that, I've been getting stronger and getting some capacity back without it knackering me for a couple of days. And so I really look at, you know, how do I feel in the workout? If it's kind of white buffalo in the sky type thing, then I'm pushing too hard. If I am laid up the next day, like I did my squat day on my Wendler kind of 5-3-1 deal, and it was my big week, the 95% squat deal, and I did 135 kilos for 13 reps, 12 reps, right around there. And then I did some front squats, and then I did some short sprints with D-ball slams, and I did that on Wednesday, or let's see, or Tuesday, today's Thursday. On Wednesday, then, I was destroyed. I could barely keep my eyes open. And so I went, I think, a little bit too hard on that day. I should have done a little bit less volume. So I've started keeping an eye on my volume, started keeping an eye on the intensity, my relative perceived effort at the stuff that I'm doing, and I'm doing much, much better. And keeping some sort of a plan in there so that I stay within my means. And like, next week is an unload week. I'm going to follow that unload week and then get back at it. And that's been very, very helpful.
Good. Yeah, I hate deload weeks.
It makes you feel like you're just kind of puttering around and like you should be doing something else. But then hopefully if you do those deload weeks correctly, you go back in the following week and you're really chomping at the bit. Like, you're ready to go. Your connective tissue and everything feels good, like that low level soreness, or maybe not low level anymore, just like the aches and pains. I notice when I'm doing too much stuff, like my hamstrings, because I'm such kind of a posterior chain dominant person, like my hamstrings when I'm training too consistently are just lit up and sore and tight all the time. And that's also kind of another little gauge. It's like, can I actually I'm pretty good at getting into the splits. And so like if I can get down in the splits, then that's kind of like a internal gauge that my inflammation and kind of neurological status is okay, that I'm not going too hard. And when I start having problems getting into that, getting down into the splits, I'm just kind of pushing too hard. Like my connective tissue is kind of fired up. I have high cortisol levels probably, and I'm just stiff and sore. And so that's a good feedback mechanism for me.
Good. Next question from John Michael. Hey, Rob, really digging the podcast. One question from number 20. You recommend not taking cod liver oil because the vitamin A has an effect on vitamin D somehow. Could you explain this for me? I've only heard good things about cod liver oil and vitamin A from the Weston A. Price Foundation, and you seem to contradict them. Are the bad effects of vitamin A only present with synthetically added supplements?
Yeah, this one is – we had somebody ask this question, and they were just at the Paleolithic Solution Seminar that we had up in Seattle, and they good on them. They did some homework, asked around a little bit, and the folks who manufacture some cod liver oil supplements were saying, no, this is absolutely false. The vitamin A has been taken in as per ancestral, diets for eons and whatnot. This was kind of new stuff to me, and John Wellborn and I got our ears pinned back by Professor Cordain when we were at the Paleo Brand Seminar back in September of last year, because we were using cod liver oil. Lauren was like, obviously you didn't read my Paleo Diet update, Paleo Diet newsletter, where he talks about this issue. There was a study that was in, I believe, a respiratory Journal of Respiratory Medicine. I have a link to it from a couple of days ago from the Paleolithic Solution, the Seattle seminar, and we can pull that out and stick it in the show notes. But basically, there was a piece that looked at upper respiratory infections in kids and looked at the relative amounts of vitamin D and vitamin A that these kids were taking in. And they found two interesting facts. And one was that these kids who had low vitamin D levels in general were at higher risk of upper respiratory infections, which makes sense on a lot of levels because of the immune modulating effects of vitamin D. But then also what they found was that kids who had high vitamin D levels but also high vitamin A levels, and vitamin A from like the retinol form of vitamin A, like what we would get out of cod liver oil, also had high rates of upper respiratory infection. And so what we take from this, there's a mechanism whereby the vitamin A ends up being competitive with the activities of vitamin D. And when we really look at kind of a reconstructed kind of ancestral diet, Professor Cordain's proposition on this is that the bulk of our vitamin A would have been obtained from conversion of carotenoids, beta carotene type carotenoids, into retinol, into the active form of vitamin A. And this happens on an as needed basis, and our retinoids, the retinoic acid retinol, ends up being occurring in much lower levels than what we would get, say, out of like a cod liver oil scenario, or eating liver out of a critter, let's say. And so the idea there is that we would generally see much higher levels of vitamin D than vitamin A, and the vitamin D being higher because of a photo exposure, sun exposure, upwards of anywhere from like 10 to 20,000 IUs of vitamin D per day, but with vitamin A levels significantly lower. And so this is the recommendation. Some of the folks push the vitamin A supplementation take some pretty good exception with this. The folks who commented on this to the reader who asked this question a few days ago said that the study was flawed that I'm referring to, but they don't offer any type of analysis to the study. So I would be curious to know what their analysis is of the study and how exactly they see it being flawed, because we, from my perspective, we have a pretty direct mechanism that's going on here and some kind of testable observations, and it seems to be pretty consistent. So I would just kind of throw back to these folks, give me some counter studies, show me a counter mechanism that we're talking about, and then we could understand where we're at. maybe I'm completely wrong on this spot. Maybe Cordain's wrong on this spot. And if I am, then I'll change my position and I'll admit some fault. But as it stands right now, we're going with the best data that we have. And this conservative recommendation seems to make sense, particularly when we can simply have people take fish oil, supplement with vitamin D, and basically focus on getting vitamin A from carotenoid type sources, and they should be just fine in that regard.
Yep. All right, good. Question from Bill. Quick question about maximizing effectiveness of carb intake on cortisol levels. In a nutshell, if carb intake is restricted sufficiently to require more or less continuous gluconeogenesis to maintain blood sugar, and cortisol is the pathway by which gluconeogenesis is activated, wouldn't eating close to zero carbs result in continuously elevated cortisol levels? Likewise, to maximize development of muscle occurring in a reduced cortisol environment, wouldn't the ideal, although perhaps unattainable, diet be the one that provided just enough carbs to nearly eliminate gluconeogenesis, thus generating the lowest levels of cortisol due to diet, all other factors being equal? Or is my understanding of this simply immature?
This one reminds me of another question that we had a while back on this, and it's really good. But cortisol is not the singular way that we can kick on gluconeogenesis. Glucagon release is another way of kicking on gluconeogenesis. We can get glucagon release simply from a large protein meal. And even within that context, if we have a large protein meal with a fair amount of fat and we have a release of fatty acids into the system, we may not even get that much of a glucagon response, but we can still certainly get gluconeogenesis from protein, catabolism, breakdown of protein producing glucose. Mike Eads has a really interesting blog post on using hepatic gluconeogenesis as a way of filling up liver and muscular glycogen. And I think that this is a tenable situation so long as protein intake is large enough. And where we could start getting into a problem is if our exercise level is of sufficient intensity or volume to start digging into glycogen reserves, both muscular and liver glycogen reserves. And if we were to deplete liver glycogen sufficiently, then we could get into a situation in which cortisol would be released, and then we could get into a problematic scenario of high cortisol levels and kind of a catabolism run wild. So that's an issue. I think that this supposition of like, let's take in at just enough carbohydrates so that I deal with my gluconeogenesis issues, but don't really impact, say, like fat burning or overall carbohydrate or insulin release, excuse me. That makes sense. That totally makes sense. And I think if we look at the metabolic diet, even some elements of the zone, some stuff that we've played with a carbohydrate repartitioning and all that. What this kind of boils down to is eat as much vegetable matter as you can that's kind of low-ish glycemic load, you know. And usually, if you're really trying to eat a lot of carbs in this manner, you end up with like 50, maybe 100 grams of carbs. And I think that's kind of a nice spot for most people to be, even if they are doing a fair amount of training, that's kind of a sustainable level. And what this should theoretically do is fill up liver glycogen and muscular glycogen enough, but we're really focused on liver glycogen specifically, should fill liver glycogen from carbohydrate enough so that you are sparing the use of protein to be used as a building material as opposed to an energy source, particularly an energy source coming from just converting it into gluconeogenesis. And so I think that that's a smart level to be at. I think taking care of post-workout nutrition is a good way of kind of optimizing that. But it's good thinking. It's definitely good thinking. Keeping some records on how your what levels of all the stuff you're consuming can help you dial this in. But I think people find this in kind of a instinctive way of eating too. But it's definitely some good thought processes going on.
Yep. All right. Good question. Next, we got a beefy one, I think. Question from Paul. I have a question for the podcast. Rob and Andy have mentioned a few times about taking digestive enzymes to aid in food absorption. James Fitzgerald also brings this up in his Nutrition 201 DVD. I found this article on Paul Ekin's website that explains how it works and how to figure out how many pills are required. However, I also found this post on T-Nation basically debunking the Paul Ekin article. I eat strict paleo, sleep 7.5 to 8.5 hours a night, and follow OPT's workouts, so I do have periodization and get proper rest. I'm desperate to improve my athletic performance. I miss qualifying regionals by 3 spots, and I was hoping that proper food absorption might be my missing link. I did the enzyme test and got the warm feeling at 6 pills using now superfood enzymes. So 5 pills each meal is my lucky number. Long question, shortened. Is Paul Ekin right about these enzymes, or is MD from T Nation right, and am I wasting my time?
You know,
what would Jim Wendler say, Rob?
He'd say eat some nachos and go lift heavy. So yeah, Wendler's actually, we have a video of Wendler saying he loves hydrochloric acid, but I think he's making some serious fun of people. So clinically, like, just my experience on this, I've seen people really, really benefit from the Now Food super enzymes. Matt Lalonde and I were talking about this, and some of the science we haven't really kind of wrapped our heads around fully, but hypochloridia is a real phenomenon in which people are not producing sufficient stomach acid. And the interesting thing is the stomach acid is less a factor in actually breaking food down specifically than it is in signaling the release of downstream digestive cofactors, like bile release from the gallbladder, stimulation of pancreatic digestive enzymes that break down protein, carbohydrate, and fat. So it's less a deal, I think, of actually that it breaks the food down specifically, but what we're doing is we're like really priming the pump or sending the signal downstream for the rest of our digestive system to be kicked on. Now, the Now Food super enzymes are kind of nice also in that they have enzymes that break down proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. They function at a pH level, which occurs in the small intestine, which is really important. Enzymes have a narrow pH frequency with which they work. And then it also has some ox bile, which I think a lot of people have problems releasing sufficient bile salts to help emulsify fats and kind of kick over the digestive process. So what I'm seeing is that people who had other, they would complain about weak digestion, bloating from meals that contain fruits and vegetables, or just generally they're like, I feel a little bit bloated, a little bit slow in my digestion. They do this whole process of figuring out where they feel heat, and with taking a betaine hydrochloride or like an Alfood super enzyme kind of gig, where they find that heat level, they dial their dosage back by like one capsule, and they stay at that level until they feel heat again, and then dial a capsule back and kind of do that process. And what these people do is they build their digestion back to where they do not need to take the digestive enzymes. And frequently these people report kind of undigested food when they in their stools, the food comes out looking the same way that it went in, particularly vegetable matter type stuff. And over the course of time, their stool quality changes. And so they start actually digesting their food. So at the end of the day, what I find is that here's some stuff to just kind of consider here. These digestive enzymes that we're recommending are dirt cheap. The Now Food super enzymes are super, super cheap. So if you want to give it a shot, it's not going to really cost you all that much. If your digestion is not working that well, like, that's a baseline kind of leaving money on the table kind of scenario that you could improve. And clinically, what I'm seeing again and again and again is that a lot of people benefit from this type of stuff. Stress, overfeeding, and all those types of things definitely impact digestive quality. One of the interesting things that I found when I did a little bit of intermittent fasting, when I wasn't overdoing it, when I wasn't doing it in an overtrained scenario, was that I noticed it improved my digestion. It seemed like my digestion was allowed some time to relax, and then I was digesting my food better, like it was coming out better broken down and all that. So I think it's very, very compelling with all this stuff. My hat is definitely thrown in on the fact that this stuff works. Pollockin recommends this stuff. OPT recommends this stuff. Czech recommends this stuff. I've seen huge benefit from a ton of people with regards to this whole process. So I would just ask, you know, even this MD who wrote the piece, you know, have you worked with people clinically who have digestive problems, and have you even tried this scenario? So maybe we don't fully understand the science behind this, but does it actually work? And it, from my perspective, it definitely does. And it's one of these things where it's pretty damn cheap. So it's not like we're shaking people down for a ton of money to do something that's a really dubious success. So,
Rob, you're making a fortune off this. Don't lie.
I am now food super enzyme. So, yeah.
Awesome. I'm glad we got that out in the open.
Seriously. Yeah, I feel better too. It was a little bit of a cathartic feeling for me to admit that. So,
next question from Jeremy Robb. Love the pseudosciencey goodness of the website podcast. So far this year, I've added 55 pounds to my deadlift, 50 pounds to my squat, 60 pounds to my bench press, all while doing a borderline ketogenic low-carb diet. Thanks for the good work. Thought I would bring this to your attention. Read it this morning. Seems like the guy is cherry-picking studies to support his point of view, and his conclusion is convoluted at best. Check it out. So we got this article from Elite FTS called Low Carb Dogma by Jamie Hale.
And it's huge. It just has a ton of material in it. He gets in and goes in and it looks at like a low carb and weight loss. And he basically, his supposition is that, you know, low carb diets do not really outperform other diets, which time and again, I think we've found this to not really be the case. Do low carbohydrate diets decrease hunger? And this is some stuff that both Mike Eads and Tobbs, you know, in Good Calories, Bad Calories, we have some really good data on this stuff showing that almost CRAN levels of calorie intake can occur on a low carb diet with virtually no sense of hunger. And the interesting point here is that I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere in Hale's background he writes a anti-low carbohydrate diet post that basically saying you shouldn't eat a low carbohydrate diet if you want to get big because it's hard to have adequate appetite to eat enough food, which I definitely have, you know, a ton of people have recognized that for some people trying to do a legitimate mass gain and eat a lot of calories, if you eat a ton of protein and fat, the satiety signals that are sent are so potent that you just don't want to eat a lot of food. And that oftentimes it's easier to consume more calories because if you include carbohydrate in the mix. And it's very well understood that in an order of magnitude, protein, then carbohydrate, or excuse me, protein, then fat, then carbohydrate release neuropeptide YY, which is one of the main stimulants for a satiety. Protein has a potent satiety signal. Fat intake is only right behind it. And then interestingly, carbohydrate is quite a bit further down the list than these other two nutrients. And then carbohydrate has the interesting side effect that if you consume enough carbohydrate, we end up converting that carbohydrate into palmitic acid. Palmitic acid, as I think we mentioned in the last podcast, is very free to pass through the blood-brain barrier and actually inhibits the sense of leptin. And leptin is another one of our very potent stimulators of satiety. So we have some known, understood mechanisms here at any given caloric intake of protein, fat being better stimulators of satiety than carbohydrate and really causing a much better response with regards to fat loss. And some of these studies, you know, like I haven't dug in on them, but, you know, he mentions in one of them that overproduction of insulin driven by carbohydrate consumption, the primary cause of obesity. Like they do some compare and contrast with some protein carbohydrate intake, but I know a bunch of this stuff, like we're doing shakes. Like there's just some really poorly designed stuff in here that I would argue is to some degree being cherry picked. And even our old friend who Krieger, James Krieger, you know, who was really taking us to task on some stuff about all this same stuff, and like Matt and I were talking about, you know, it saying simply insulin is a little bit oversimplistic because protein sources like fish and beef release insulin. And so why don't those things cause in significant amounts of insulin? So why don't those things cause insulin resistance? Well, part of insulin resistance is being set up by changes in hepatic status with regards to like palmitic acid production and what can happen with leptin sensitivity. So it's an oversimplification. If you want to geek out on another level, then yeah, it's like okay. Simply spiking insulin is not the causative factor in insulin resistance. That is true. Like we need another layer of sophistication if we want to be completely accurate. But the thing is that clinically, what you do to address the situation is no damn different. Like we still need to regulate carbohydrate levels to a point that relative to each individual, we are not causing hepatic essentially an overload of either fructose or glucose so that we overfill hepatic liver glycogen and start causing problems downstream from there. So when you really get down to brass tacks, simply saying insulin spiking is inaccurate because we have situations in which protein sources can raise insulin. So that's true. But it really doesn't change anything. And when you look at people who are actually effective at changing body composition in people and in large numbers of people, by and large, these people are defaulting to some sort of a carbohydrate-controlled scenario. You don't see Weight Watchers-esque, like Dean Ornish-esque type people doing calorie-restricted, higher-carbohydrate diets working in the vast majority of people. We just don't see this stuff happening. And again, like the work from Stefan Lindberg, and they just had a new piece in a clinical trial, like a metabolic ward trial of a paleo diet being compared against standard, you know, a grain-based diet. These aren't even low carbohydrate levels, but paleo-type carbs affecting blood glucose levels in very different ways because of lectin effects, because of cortisol effects, and a bunch of other issues. So like these food quality issues, the total amount of carbohydrate, this stuff matters, and it definitely matters on another order of magnitude beyond simply insulin sensitivity. But for simplicity, that statement works. And if you put these guys' feet to the fire, if you want to see people succeed and succeed in large numbers, then you start looking at carbohydrate control protocols, especially carbohydrate control protocols with paleo type carb. And I know these guys don't like that, and everybody wants to be a unique flower, and particularly like the Lyle McDonald kind of camp who I think that they were so close to having so much of this stuff right. I think they're just kind of pissed off that they missed some kind of obvious pieces here and could have had the whole thing kind of tied together. But again and again and again, we see these consistency. So I would throw back to Hale, you know, explain to me why we see a significant difference in the study that Stefan Lindberg did in which he compares groups of type 2 diabetics eating similar amounts of protein, carbohydrate, and fat, but in one group the carbohydrates are from what we would consider paleo sources, roots, tubers, fruit, veggies. And the other group, we have a standard kind of grain, legume, and dairy-based approach. And in the paleo scenario, we have a resolution of type 2 diabetes. Essentially, these people become non-diabetic on this approach, whereas the grain, legume, and dairy-based Mediterranean-type diet does not improve blood lipid parameters at all. So why? Why are we seeing this issue? Why are we not seeing a resolution of the issue? And this is a very well-controlled, it's a clinical trial. It's kind of a gold standard with regards to this. And the rest of this stuff, surveys and a bunch of other things that are basically crap. Like it can give you maybe some guidelines, but it's absolutely nothing to hang your hat on. So I would want to hear the response to that, why we have a distinction there, and how does that play into the overall picture.
Yep. All right, good. You're pretty calm today, Rob, so that was a polite answer, I think, for you.
I'm trying not to be too big of a jerk, so...
Next, we got a question from Danny, newbie alert. He says, hi, Rob. First of a bit of background on me, I have gone from doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu 3 times a week and CrossFit 3 times a week plus Ashtanga Yoga 2 times a week. This is all from snapping my ACL in my right knee. So I assume he snapped his ACL after doing all that work. I've had surgery on it and looking at getting back in training. I'm looking to start eating the paleo way, however. What would you say are the best books for newbies like me to set me on the right track, i.e. what to eat and when? What's your take on a whole wheatgrass juice trend? I love that question. Along with taking glucosamine and omega, what other supplement would I need? He's 5'10", weighs 13 stone 5, and not loving my body shape. Once again, thanks for your podcast. Been a great help on other aspects of the paleo way for us UK listeners. Much love to the podcast. Danny from Manchester, UK.
Wow, he managed to sneak like 15 questions into this thing. It's like super short entry, which is great, and then like 20 questions. So great books, Protein Power Life Plan, phenomenal. Lights Out, Sleep, Sugar, Survival, really amazing. Still really like Natural Hormonal Enhancement is a really solid book. I think The Primal Blueprint is a great book for getting folks dialed in on all this stuff. What to eat and when. I mean, really, this is pretty simple stuff. Like if you're not lean, control carbohydrate levels, which most of these books are going to kind of steer you in that direction. If you're trying to optimize some performance, then we're going to start looking at post-workout recovery kind of considerations, which are protein and carbohydrate driven. I've done a ton of blog posts on this, just specific post-workout recovery and the trade-offs. Like, am I trying to lean out? Am I trying to optimize performance? Make sure you understand who you are and what you're trying to do, because you need to focus on one specific goal to get that stuff done. Wheatgrass, I'm not a fan of. It just kind of freaks me out. I think there might be some lectins in there. You could play around with it. I'm just not really a fan of that. Pulikan's not a fan of the green foods that are derivatives of wheat, barley, you know, rye, grasses, and so I tend to kind of side with that. Glucosamine and omega is good. Magnesium, you know, ZMA or a natural calm kind of dealio. And I think that pretty much hits his questions. Were you trying to set me up for more more of an
no,
answer?
No, that wasn't so bad at all.
Yeah.
See, you're calm. All right. good. Next question from Matt. Rob, love the podcast. You mentioned cortisol issues and working on a fasted state, and I was hoping you could go into that some more. I currently train at a 6 a.m. class, so usually don't eat anything before working out. I'm making decent progress with regular PRs across the board, but I'm having trouble dropping some of the excess fat around the umbilicus, which you've mentioned before as a possible sign of cortisol issues. What is the mechanism by which fasted training affects cortisol production? I know Martin Beckham, we never know how to say
it. We never get it right, yeah.
We're sorry, Martin. At Lean Gains, talks about taking BCAAs before fasted training to promote muscle growth. Would BCAAs be enough to counteract whatever causes elevated cortisol during fasted training? Let's just start there.
Yeah. So let's see here. What's the mechanism with fasted training? So as a baseline, particularly if you're doing something like a CrossFit sort of gig, you jump in, you start doing high intensity full body movements, say like thruster, pull up, run, which these movements are very, very glucose demanding. They're very glycogen demanding. At any given moment, we have a circulating pool of glucose that is just in our bloodstream. That glucose is titrating into our muscles and our brain and our organs and tissues at some sort of a slow rate. And like if we're fat adapted, then different tissues will run more on like fat and ketone bodies than it will on just specifically glucose. But there's still stuff that will only run on glucose. And so that's just kind of some stuff to keep in mind. And so we launch in, we start doing a workout, and our muscular glycogen starts, we start burning through it immediately. And this is where we start producing blood lactate, you know, start getting muscle burning. But this stimulus of burning through muscle glycogen, it decreases essentially the stored carbohydrate in the muscles, and it opens the door for glucose to go out of the bloodstream and into the muscles to start propping up the glycogen in the muscles to allow us to perform. Now, if our liver glycogen is stocked enough, then we can get a bump up in liver production without really releasing cortisol. We can start propping up blood glucose levels and not really get too much of a cortisol release. Adrenaline, growth hormone can promote this stuff. These things are released in response to kind of anticipatory excitement. High blood lactate levels can start driving this stuff a little bit. But if we are too low if our blood sugar dips too low, say like we work out very, very hard, very quickly, and we don't have a lot of muscle glycogen or liver glycogen stored, then we can start getting a cortisol response, which will start breaking down proteins to make blood glucose, help to prop that up. And we can start breaking down branched chain amino acids that are circulating in the blood and converting those into glucose. So this is the whole process that's going on. And this is where like just a little sniggle of protein or like a branched chain amino acid supplement, or just a smidge of carbohydrate, really just like 5 or 10 grams of carbohydrate, doesn't need to be much at all, can really help prop up blood glucose levels and prevent a really significant cortisol response. Now, depending on where you're at in this whole spectrum, some fasted training may be totally fine. You may mainly get a growth hormone release out of this. And this is a lot of what Art Devaney talks about. But you need to be well rested. You need to have some of your other ducks in a row. 6 a.m. class is almost guaranteed that you're getting up with an alarm. Almost guaranteed you're waking up with inadequate sleep. And so when we start talking about leaning out, cortisol issue becomes a big factor, but you know, it's not just cortisol, it's also just the lack of sleep. And you know, it gets hard because like people have silly stuff like jobs that they need to get up and get their workout in so that they can then go to work and get all that stuff done in a timely manner. But these are some of the factors that are going on behind the scenes. Sleep, cortisol levels, all that sort of jive. I think the recommendation for some BCAAs, branched chain amino acids, before training definitely makes sense. You can play with it, see if it helps your situation. But as we go back to again and again, nutritional tinkering will help lack of sleep, but it won't fix it. I wish we could undo all of sleep issues with nutrition, but we can't. I wish that there were other supplements that we could do that would undo it, but it just doesn't cut it.
I also just want to read his calorie thing. I thought it was interesting.
Maybe yeah, and he mentions his sleep in this too.
Yeah. I recently cut my calories from 2,300 a day to about 1,800. I'm weighing and measuring mostly to ensure I'm getting enough protein. Don't think I'm overtraining and have no real stress to speak of. The only other factor I can think of that might be causing cortisol issues is sleep. I usually get about 6.5 hours during the week, 7 to 7.5 on the weekends. I usually don't have any issues falling asleep or staying asleep, but once I wake up, that's usually it for me. 5'11", 180, CrossFit Mateside Wads, 5 on, 2 off. 880 grams of protein a day, less than 50 carbs, fish oil, vitamin D, magnesium, etc.
Yeah, you could do some some tinkering with post workout carb repletion and see if this helps. The lack of sleep is concerning to me. Like I'd like to see an 8 to 9 in there, right? Ideally, you know. And this could be a deal where maybe some additional magnesium, some natural calm, maybe modulating your intensity a little bit. Like, I would want to know why and when specifically he's waking up. I would like to see, you know, better sleep throughout the night and all that sort of stuff. And as soon as those things start falling into place, then we start seeing people lean out. Like, it's just kind of an if A, then B kind of scenario.
What are your thoughts on main site WADs 5 on, 2 off? That seems pretty excessive.
It's tough. You know, like, originally, they had kind of a couple of theoretical templates with that, you know, like a 3 on, 1 off, and then a 5 on, 2 off. And even in their original CrossFit Journal piece, they admitted that, you know, the folks following the 5 on, 2 off, they were pretty torched by the end of that whole scene. Larry Lindemann, really bright dude who was around the CrossFit scene early on, he very early kind of instinctively figured out that maybe he would do one day kind of as prescribed, second day half volume, third day maybe three quarters volume. So he started instituting his own kind of modifications on the programming. And this is back before even the, you know, I would say that the volume on that training has just gotten bigger and bigger with time. Instead of getting more sophisticated, it's just kind of gone more volume. And I think that that's a significant problem for most people. So depending on your work, you know, your schedule, say like people want to work out through the week and then have the weekends off, that's totally legit. But I think doing something like a max effort black box kind of gig where, you know, Rutt has some really slick protocols where like 1 week you would do 3 max effort days, 2 Metcon days, and then the rotate and 3 Metcon days, 2 max effort days, and you kind of have a rotating template like that. So you're getting 5 days a week of training. You could drop in some skill work, like some gymnastics work in addition to your max effort work, just to get a little bit more, you know, fun stuff in there. But I think something like that where you're really tackling the whole thing in a more punctuated manner, not quite as much cortisol intensive, like lactate intensive type training, could be a really good move. And you know, we just never see people suffer from kind of a focus on technical strength oriented training. They always seem to benefit from that. Yeah, but that's a blistering schedule. But for some people, that's just what fits in with their lifestyle and how they want to train, and that totally is legit. But I would give some thought towards ways to modify all that.
Yep.
And if it's gauche to do max effort black box because Rutt's kind of, you know, on the outs, then you could always do the newly anointed West Side Barbell for CrossFit.
Rob, leave Louie out of this. And with that, Rob, that's the last question of the day.
Damn it. Okay, I guess we'll get to Sundog next time. So
yeah, we'll do Sundog the first of the next episode.
That's a biggie, so cool.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir. You enjoy the rest of your week, and have a good weekend. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, dude. Enjoy your first margarita and coffee or whatever you're going to do here soon.
Thanks, man. I'll talk to you.
All right, bye, Andy.
Bye.